Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Laura Flanders. She's the host of Radio Nation on Air America Radio Network, and she's the author of a number of books, including Bushwomen, Tales of a Cynical Species, The W Effect, Sexual Politics in the Bush Years and Beyond, and her current book is called Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. It's published by the Penguin Press. Welcome, Laura.
Oh, I'm glad to be with you, Mary Charlotte.
Now, this book addresses the disconnect between politicians in Washington and their base in the 50 states and D.C. How would you describe the diverse groups of people who make up the Democratic base?
Wow, it's huge, isn't it? I mean, it was once upon a time you could say, well, it was the black and the blue. It was the black churches and the blue-collar workers. But I think today it's far more diverse than that. I mean, just talking social groups, you've got gays and lesbians, you've got reproductive rights-seeking women and the health services that support them. You've got now a whole group of liberal religious folks of different kinds. They've always been there. We just haven't really paid much attention to them up to now. You've got young people. Majority of those, you know, vast majority of young voters vote Democratic. And that's just some of the demographic groups. You've still got Native Americans, of course, and labor voters, as always. But I believe that part of the problem on the Democratic side is its base voters need to be kind of remapped. Then, you know, within those who call themselves Democrats, you've got everybody from sort of independent, socialist-leaning people who vote for Bernie Sanders in Vermont, right through to what they call the yellow dog Democrats, the pro so-called free trade, corporate defined trade, people who say they'll win by campaigning against things like gay marriage and reproductive rights. So it's a huge and very diverse picture.
The Republican base is also huge. You have everything from, Wall Street, Fortune 500 people to blue-collar workers in rural areas. They have managed to be unified through some very clever politicking over the last couple of decades. What about the Democratic Party? What is their relationship like to this very large base?
Well, I say that it's not just politics. It's also pragmatics. I mean, on the left, we tend to look at the right and say, oh, this is this top-down, hierarchical, they tell you what to do organization. Yeah, there's a lot of leadership at the top, but there's also a belief in servicing the base. So you have across the country social networks of, gun club folks and religious right organizations and others who have been carefully networked into the state party apparatus. On the Democratic side, as I traveled around the country, it was very different. In most parts of the country, there kind of was no functioning Democratic Party, and those social networks that I've just described are kind of kept at a distance. If they receive money in election season to help turn out the vote, it's a very kind of feast or famine phenomenon. If they happen to be in a swing state for as long as that state continues to be considered worth it by the Democratic campaign, they may see some bucks, but the rest of the year and the years in between, it's sort of famine season. So it's a very different dynamic, I think. And I was very struck as I researched Blue Grit that while journalists and the press tend to focus on the ideological, the pragmatic institutional picture on the Democratic side really needs a second look.
Your book is full of amazing characters like Rocky Anderson, the mayor of Salt Lake City. Tell us about him and his rise to political prominence.
Oh, well, he's fantastic. I mean, he's one of those people who's just a surprise in the heartland. I mean, I started the book by going to Utah. The book, I should say, really had its sort of roots on election night 2004 when I was on the air and on Air America Radio speaking to a very downcast Democratic voting group. They were just miserable. Their hearts were breaking. And I tried to spend the evening cheering them up, saying, you know, White House not good, but a lot of other things worth paying attention to weren't so bad. Great turnout. Democrats managed to raise as much money as the Republicans for the first time. Grassroots groups in two red states, Florida and Nevada managed to raise the minimum wage. You know, it's not all bad. And I went home thinking, am I just dreaming, you know? And decided to go out and take a look. So the question in my mind was, is this country just awash in conservative values, or is somebody just not doing politics right? And the first place I decided to go was Utah, because it's the reddest state you're going to find on those electoral college maps. I mean, there's no question about it. The state hasn't voted for a Democrat since 1964. But there you have mayor of the largest city in Utah, Salt Lake City, Ross Rocky Anderson, a man who's sort of the most progressive mayor you're ever likely to meet. He's pro-gay marriage. He's for sentencing reform. He's for he signed his city up to meet the Kyoto protocols on greenhouse gas emissions. He's meeting them way ahead of schedule. And when the president comes to town, he greets him not with, you know, a motorcade, but with a massive demonstration.
Right, that's amazing.
Which he excoriates his politics. So, you know, Utah reminded me, even those red states have big blue dots, and those are the cities. Every city with 500,000 people or more votes Democratic.
Well, what's amazing is that the Democratic Party of Utah does not embrace this Mayor Rocky Anderson.
No, they make him very, he makes them very nervous, and that's kind of what I meant by the title Blue Grit. The true Democrats I'm talking about, a lot of them with small D, not capital D, are the type of folks who have the power to inspire and the stubbornness to get the tough stuff done. But they're also like that sort of pesky gravel in your shoe. They can make you pretty uncomfortable, and that's exactly what they do to the Democratic establishment. So in Utah, you're right, when Rocky ran for Congress in 1999, he won the primary, much to the dismay of the Democratic establishment. They went on to pretend he didn't exist, and he campaigned without ever appearing on any Democratic Party election literature and without receiving from them even $1, even 1 cent. Now, needless to say, he lost. He says it was because, you know, how much, you know, what does it take to lose against a guy who's outspending you 10 to 1 and just repeating that you're pro-gay marriage in Utah? They say, well, it shows how his positions were too out of touch with a base. I think it's up for debate. In fact, what we're seeing in Salt Lake City is that his policies and his approach to governing are winning even his critics over, who have respect for how much he's getting done and how he treats them and how he stands up for what he believes, whether they like him or not. He's gained their respect.
Well, the relationship between people like Rocky Anderson and the Democrats in their area, that's a thread throughout the book. Where did Democrats get the idea that they should stay away from issues that express Democratic values, like gay marriage, like civil rights, like unions, sexual politics?
Well, I don't know, but it looks to me as if they started getting very quiet about all those sorts of so-called social issues in the late 80s, early 90s, which, again, just surmising from history, also seems to coincide with exactly the time that they decide to break with labor over the North American Free Trade Agreement and suck up to big business instead. I mean, from the facts, you could infer that the party at some point decided, heck, we don't want to be the party of people of color and women and queers. We want to be the party of big business, just like the other side. Besides, it makes it so much easier to raise money. We only have to go to a few people with deep pockets rather than that annoying job of actually maintaining a base and building a network in all the states. So it looks to me as if that's what happened. Did somebody sometime make the decision? I don't think so, but I mean, I don't know so, but Kevin Phillips and others have suggested that that's exactly what happened, as did William Grider in his book, Who Will Tell the People? He paints a picture where basically the Democratic leadership sat around and decided exactly that.
We're talking to Laura Flanders, author of the book Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. Well, one problem the Democrats really do have is that they are divided between, on the one hand, their need to please big business. They get their support from there. On the other hand, their duty to oppose big business's destructiveness on the people, on the planet. And whereas Republicans are unified in their support for big business, they don't have any qualms about it. They don't bother with the little guy or the environment. Do you see Democrats examining that split that they have within themselves?
Well, I didn't see it this last week when we saw yet another so-called free trade pact drawn up by the Democrats in Congress. It's kind of shocking that after having won a majority in Washington, in part thanks to a big fair trade mandate, the one legacy accomplishment that this Congress seems to have actually managed to get the, you know, carry through to the support of the White House is a so-called free trade arrangement with Panama, Peru, and we don't know all the details because it's been kept secret even from the Democratic leadership. So are they re-examining that? They sure should be, it seems to me. Certainly in the Senate, their margin of victory comes from people like Jim Webb and John Tester in Montana, senators who ran flat out on a campaign of fair trade and reviewing our the Democrats' lockstep march with big business. I think that there's no question that that was the message of Election 06, among other things. It's not just me that says so. Forbes magazine, Fortune 500 companies all make the same assessment. And yet, there you have the Democrats going ahead with a trade pact that has provoked the ire once again of the major labor groups. So, I don't know. You tell me. I can't explain it.
You got me. But, I mean, I guess it has to do just pure and simple with campaign contributions.
Well, I'm afraid it might. We covered it on our show this weekend, and that's pretty much what Paul Krugman said of the New York Times. They've got their eye on campaign contributors, and I hate to think it's as simple as that, but it just might be.
In the late 1970s, post-Nixon, post-Vietnam, the Democrats had not only control over Washington, but really the hearts and minds of the citizens. And there was a movement of conservatives, which is well documented by many people, including George Lakoff and so on, to reclaim power. It's not well known to a lot of people, but it's not a secret either. How did they do it?
Oh, well, I talked to some of those folks. In fact, one of them ended up blurbing my book. I've got a very strange coalition of blurbers on Blue Grit.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody from Chuck D to Richard Viguerie, who was one of those who moved the party to the right by building a powerful right-wing kind of hammer to beat the middle with. He said, you know, we didn't just learn from the left. We learned from the far left. We learned from the Communist Party. We learned how to create kind of powerful cells that could have influence at the local level. They targeted not Democrats, but centrist Republicans they didn't like. They pushed the whole institution to the right by basically picking off the candidates they thought were weak on their issues and picking fights that they thought, even if they couldn't win, at least could advance their ideological agenda. So if they're picking fights around taxation or immigration or overturning Roe v. Wade, at once upon a time, those looked like crazy battles to pick. But now they're in the middle of the debate. They could be accomplished some of them any day. And this is a function of long-term thinking, strategic research, and working from the base level up. The other thing they did is listen. They listened to people's grievances. They didn't necessarily answer those grievances, but they sure, made hay of them. People's grievances against the media, they were able to spin into this hatred of not just the media, but a media that they cast as liberal media, putting all journalists on the defensive. And we've seen the impact of that. Their grievances against their situation in the workplace, people's grievances, they were able to kind of manipulate into scapegoating women and immigrants. They listened, which I'm afraid is something Democrats are pretty reluctant to. I mean, gee, it seems as if we had to get a big fat megaphone and say, end the troop presence in Iraq before anybody in D.C. would really listen or take heed or notice that this wasn't just morally right but a mainstream view.
They also did career development for their young people, development of the media, multi-year funding of the organizations that supported them, and that had a huge impact.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, the things that had the big impact were picking primary fights, which is something the Democratic Party hates people to do, but some of my Blue Grit heroes are beginning to do just that. They did consistent funding of groups they cared about, which is something we still struggle to see foundations and philanthropists do on the left. And, yeah, they cultivated young people. I interviewed this lovely, charming fellow who was the head of College Republicans in Utah, and he said, you know, he was 18, I think he's 18 or 19 years old when I met him in early 06, and he had already been to five national conservative conferences. So he's already well identified in his own head and to his social network as a conservative, and he's met some of his heroes and spoken to them, shook their hand, sat down to talk with Newt Gingrich and Bill Bennett and Gary Will, you name it. He's his identity is carefully is well framed, if you will, cemented. And even though he didn't like half the things the Bush administration was doing, I asked him about the Patriot Act, about the war. He was against all of those. But still, he said, I'm a conservative, and the problem is this government's not being true to its conservative roots. What was so revealing was he said, our college Republican group, this is at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, receives every month a kind of care package from the Republican headquarters in Washington. And they can even call for technical assistance on their campus newspapers, you name it. On the Democratic side, he said he was kind of sorry for his Democratic colleagues because this was about February of 06. He said they had just received their first package of materials from Democrats that month.
And so this young person's sense of identity, sense of belonging, and sense of confidence are really cultivated.
Yeah, and for free. He got to attend all these conferences, I think, for $25.
There's a movement now among wealthy liberal funders to do the same thing, fund think tanks and, you know, career development to some extent and so on. What are they actually doing and how's it working out so far?
Well, good question. I mean, one of the most sort of attention-grabbing initiatives recently has been something called the Democracy Alliance, which is a group of funders who had previously poured a lot of money into campaigns, presidential campaigns and other national, you know, state and Senate and congressional campaign races. And after 04 said, that's it. There's a problem with how we're doing politics. Let's do something different. And they decided instead of funding candidates, many of them, they would fund, or not instead of, they actually pledged not to stop their funding of candidates, but to fund as well grassroots organizing, because they did get it, to their credit, that something was wrong at the roots. So they have made a pledge to try to build grassroots groups that could be effective, cultivating candidates, cultivating campaign workers, doing media, you name it. But what they funded, your guess is almost as good as mine. There is no transparency, no accountability, and by all accounts, as much idiosyncrasy in who they're funding as there ever was. They may be getting themselves a little bit more educated about what groups are out there, but there's very little, again, respect for learning or patience for learning the sort of long-term strategies that have been embraced by the right and learning what I think needs to be learned about what's working in this country already. It's not simply that there are no grassroots groups that are functioning, that progressives are failing in the states. There are huge progressive victories in the states, whether you look at the ballot initiatives to raise the minimum wage or increase commitment to biofuels, or you look at the movement for, as I said, sentencing reform for those who are drug addicts. That's huge in many of the heartland states where the meth addiction is taking its toll.
Well, not to mention, I mean, I don't like to be cynical here, but the presidential elections of 2000 and arguably 2004 were actually won by Democrats.
Well, there is that argument, and I would agree with you on that. And I think they were won and also lost by Democrats who simply hadn't done the work to pay attention to shenanigans at the polls, hadn't seemed to care very much, and certainly after the fact didn't put up much of a fight. So I say it was both, yeah, won and lost by Democrats. They kind of gave it away in some states. But my pitch is really for those funders to, instead of simply focusing on the right, what did the right do? Let's do what they did. Small group of funders ideologically pursue their goals. Look at what the left is doing that works. Look at how Arnold Schwarzenegger's initiatives were defeated in 05. Look at what has happened in states like Montana that have grown a base to elect a senator and a governor and reclaim power at the state house. You know, we tend to look just at the top of the iceberg, the tip, and not see what's happening at the base. And that means that we constantly undervalue really what is the engine in our elections. Those who get people to the polls, get people educated about the issues, and, you know, amp up the enthusiasm about any given race.
There's also this dynamic, and I don't know if it's something that you see out there, but liberals tend to want to fund direct services to people who are most needy, to habitats and so on, whereas conservatives really want to increase their own power. Liberals tend to neglect the nurturing of their own leaders.
Well, you know, I mean, to be fair, there is certainly an imbalance on these two sides. On the one, you've got an ideologically driven group of conservative funders who have a very clear agenda. They want to maximize profit and minimize government intervention in their lives. No ambivalence there. On the other side of the spectrum, you've got a lot of other corporations who are also deriving their funds from the very same economic structure and have to admit they're benefiting from Bush tax cuts at the very highest level. But they've also got the demands on them split in that they are trying to fill the hole in social services that cutbacks at the government level have left, while also, you know, trying to change the legislative picture in a climate where foundations that rely on government approval for their tax-exempt status are always scared of being attacked as being too partisan or too far to the left. There is an imbalance at the media level, in the Congress, the alacrity with which we attack people for partisanship on the left is very different from that which happens on the right. And there is real need out there to fund services. So I don't blame a foundation like the Ford Foundation for being, split about how they dedicate their resources. Part of my complaint is that we on the left continue to believe that foundation support and philanthropy will save us when it won't. We have to figure out income streams for the work that we do so that we can have some dependence. And as one of my interviewees said, you know, stop playing politics in the sandbox.
We're talking to Laura Flanders. How is the relationship between the grassroots and the Democratic Party similar to or different from that relationship during the 1960s and 70s?
Well, you're going before my time there, but I think that what we saw on the Democratic side over the last 30 years has been, really 40 years, has been a kind of movement away from power at the state level and the local level towards power in Washington, D.C. and at the top. So that, for example, in the 1970s, you saw changes in the rules governing the national conventions such that way more was decided in advance. You didn't have, you know, we haven't had since the 70s those kind of floor fights among delegates from different candidates' camps because pretty much all the deals are struck in back rooms before the convention ever happens, and it's considered unseemly and wrong for a candidate's delegates to change their minds, for example, on the floor of the convention. The irony is that that process of change, reducing the power of the base, or at least making it a relationship between kind of state party chairs in Washington, as opposed to sort of state-level elections, is time to, it coincides exactly with the period at which the party, if you go back to the 60s, was for the first time inviting African-Americans and people of color to be on their side, to be part of their base. So you had this strange phenomenon in the 1960s of, you know, African-Americans, for example, in Mississippi in 64, being basically told, if you get enough black voters registered, you'll have a chance to be part of the delegation that goes to the convention. Well, they did at the cost of, you know, many lives in the Klan era. They registered tens of thousands of voters to the Mississippi Democratic Freedom, the Freedom Democratic Party. They went to the Atlantic City Convention, and they were not seated because the party actually, when push came to shove, didn't want to disempower the segregationists in the South for fear that they would leave altogether, didn't want to unseat them, and, you know, hoped that the African-Americans would wait around even if they were kept, you know, on the steps of the convention outside. So
the accusation of spinelessness has a long history.
It has a long history. And more than that, this experience of people saying, of people being told, we want you to be part of this. We are here for you. And then when they try to enter that door, finding it actually slammed in their face, goes way back. And I should say, you know, of course the Democratic Party did change, and eventually the Mississippi segregated all-white Mississippi delegation was unseated, but it took a while, and I think that period is a period like this one, where a lot of grassroots hopes are raised. maybe now the party can change. And that's what I'm writing about, that there are people that never thought they would do electoral politics that are now doing it. And the question is, will they be allowed not only to come to the table, but to kind of remake the table? Because they have that right. And I think pretty soon, being a foot soldier for higher-ups, the thrill of that wears off.
Your book, Blue Grid, as you talked about, came not only from your work on Air America and New York and listening to all the people who are calling in from all over the country, but you're traveling to far from New York, faraway places like Utah and Montana, just around the corner from New Mexico. And a lot of places are not true to stereotypes of red and blue states. And I think that kind of division and polarizing is something that's really perpetrated by the media more than it is a reality on the ground. What did you find, for example, in Montana?
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, again, I say that those electoral college maps, the red and the blue, really do mess with our heads. As I've said, you know, cities are all blue. So it's also true that some of the states like Montana that seem red, that vote for Republicans for president, at the state level, are pretty blue. And increasingly blue in these days. In Montana, you know, we heard a lot about, you know, and I guess one of my questions is, why such little curiosity about that in our journal, in our reporting, in our media? And why such poor understanding of how politics actually play out? I mean, if you only watch TV or listen to the pundits, you'd think, wow, there are just blue people and there are red people, and some live in these states and some live in those. It's not that way. All these colors have shifted over the years. Texas was a solidly Democratic state in the early 80s. Montana was solidly Democratic right through to 1980 when Reagan carried the place. It had progressive representatives in Congress right through to the middle 1990s. I talked to one of them, Pete Williams. He said, you know, I kept trying to talk to leadership in D.C. about how I keep in power. He's one of the longest serving members in the Congress. And nobody seems interested. They've written the place off, and they seem to think I'm just a quirk. I'm not a quirk, he said. There were real reasons that kept me elected.
And today, what were some of those reasons?
Well, that he drew for his political kind of framing, if you will, for his sense of self and his representation on the history of progressive populism in Montana. We hear a lot about populism, but populism isn't just that I want to be alone, don't leave, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with government. It's also the, you know, we can do this together. We can figure out our problems together approach that. Well, Montanans in the early 70s adopted that approach to rewrite their state constitution, and you had hundreds of regular Montanans, no politicians allowed, coming up with a document that they agreed on by consensus and that guaranteed them things I wish we had in the federal document, things like, you know, right to a clean and healthy environment and personal privacy and public records. You know, he said that he understood the state and could draw on its history to great effect. And I think that's one of the problems with these kind of campaigns done by D.C. is they're out of touch. They don't pay attention to what might work at the base. They also don't study what does work. And that's one of my complaints, and Montana was a case in point.
One thing you say about Montana is that the state didn't so much swing to the right as it was pushed by pretty harsh GOP tactics. What actually happened?
Well, the Republicans won the presidency, of course, under in Ronald Reagan's day, and they kept it. And the Republicans looked at that and they said, we can make inroads here in these western states. And they did it by supporting, as I said, grassroots groups inside and outside the party structure. The more radical were those kind of anti-environmentalist, corporate-funded, so-called wise use groups that blamed everybody's problems on environmentalists. The others were people like Ralph Reed's Christian Coalition, and Ralph Reed would come out to Utah and hold sort of, rallies to amp up the volume at the level of, you know, we need to exercise. I think he talked about we need to train an army to take our enemies out, and he was talking about people like Pete Williams, the progressive congressman I mentioned, mm-hmm. who was, you know, pursued relentlessly for his votes on funding in the arts and funding for civil rights and other things. They had this kind of national, how can we swell the troops strategy, that I'm afraid the Democrats have been very slow to mimic. On the Democratic side, it's gradually happening. And what frustrates me is you had in 2004, one of the victories of the night for Democrats was this election of a Democratic governor in Montana, Brian Schweitzer. And people talked about a miracle, as if, you know, he managed to win over the state because of his cowboy boots and bolo tie. But I say, you know,
as opposed to his policies.
Right, or what was happening on the ground. I say to look at the miracle is to kind of see only the beaming boy, a beaming baby boy, and ignore the 9 months of mom. And what really had happened was 10 years of work by a pretty well-embedded grassroots Democratic Party and grassroots groups like women's groups and environmental groups and Native Americans who had looked at what had happened to their state under this onslaught from the right and said, we've got to do something, and they did it.
We're talking to Laura Flanders, author of the book Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. We've heard ad nauseum from media reform groups, deconstructions of the claims about the so-called liberal media. To what extent are there actually liberal media in the United States, and how widely are they heard, seen, and read?
Well, I'm one that has for years talked about structural imbalance and the sort of the myth of liberal media. And I think at the level of the Wall Street Journal editorial page, Fox TV, and most of our evening news shows, there's no question that this is no liberal media. This is a media that has a quota of about 2 progressive voices and a quota of about, you know, an unending, an open door policy with regard to extremists from the right. So at that level,
and even the New York Times is hardly liberal much of the time.
Right. I mean, it has maybe one columnist, Bob Herbert, who regularly reports on low, you know, on poor people's issues and people of color's issues, has regularly reported on the anti-war movement and articulated, you know, his view on their behalf. You've got one economist, Paul Krugman, who is for free trade, but he is concerned about the gap of income gap between rich and poor. You know, it's hardly, you know, a liberal stomping ground, or certainly not a left stomping ground. In this book, I tried to take a different approach in that I kind of got fed up with Democrats complaining about not having a megaphone when throughout the election season, I was hearing from people calling my show saying, how do I get a Kerry Edwards yard sign? And to me, that suggested, you know, somebody is not serving the base. I live in New York. I don't even have a yard, let alone a yard sign. And you're calling me for a yard sign? Something is up. If you can't even get your own partisans the sort of basic tool of backyard or front yard communications, you've really not got any right to be blaming the media for failing to advance your message. So with that in mind, I decided to take stock and realized, you know, we have a ton of really good, progressive, lefty, independent media, from grassroots radio like this to independent, you know, publications, weeklies, and internet sites. I'm not saying it's enough, but I'm saying that there's a sort of whine factor on the left that if only we had the media. We have a lot of media. We just don't like to fund it very much. And it's not as if the media will make the movement. The movement, with media help, can advance an agenda, but the media can't do it on its own.
The political right seems to focus on anything that has to do with sex, gay rights, abortion, women's roles, and by extension, masculine roles like the military. They use it to their advantage. What's going on with that? What are the psychological and political dynamics, and why is the anti-gay movement so, well, relatively successful?
Well, you're right. The right is obsessed with sex, and that was why it was so genius what Jane Fonda did the other day on the Colbert Report. Don't know whether you saw it, but he'd been, you know, sort of making sexist jokes about her, and she called him on it by leaping onto his lap and giving him a big smooch on the lips. Totally freaked him out. And it was a great moment of kind of, yeah, exactly. You're obsessed with sex here, but let's get real. You are utterly frazzled by this. So, I don't know. I mean, I think that there's been a chorus, and there was after 2004, that what Democrats needed to do was to kind of drop these uncomfortable making so-called social issues, and by that they mean gay marriage and abortion rights, racial justice, that kind of thing. I don't ever understand how those things got to be called social. If you've ever been discriminated against on the basis of your race or your gender or the fact that you're pregnant, you don't feel it in your sewing circle. You feel it in your pocketbook. So I don't see how they got to be social, as opposed to the
economic,
good, real stuff of economics.
Right.
But that's the framing. You have sort of the important class issues, and then you have this kind of fluffy other stuff. The message is not only misguided and wrong, but it's pragmatically stupid, it seems to me. It's wrong in that it's morally wrong, and the Democrats know that. They're never going to be anti-gay, anti-abortion, anti-racial justice enough to please their critics. All they're doing is alienating their allies. It's pragmatically wrong because, look, they don't have a choice about taking these issues on. It's being brought to them, just as this question of gay marriage was brought to the gay and lesbian movement. Probably wasn't on their schedule or at their choice. These issues are going to be dogging Democratic candidates, whether they like it or not, and all they're doing by keeping them at a distance, and the people who know about them at a distance, is undermining their own ability to effectively address these issues and win on them. I say that winning on these issues is possible. In fact, if you look at the shortest little span of history that we've been living through, these issues, particularly gay marriage, have been winners. If you look at it, you've got going in the last 12 years to now, a country that at this point 66% of people support some kind of legal recognition for same-sex couples. I mean, that's extraordinary. This issue wasn't even on the map a decade ago. So on the one hand, they're not necessarily losers. And on the other hand, and there are people running on these issues and winning all over the country, and I write about them in Blue Grit. You want to know how to run in a conservative area on a pro-marriage equality platform, just check out the book. But the other thing I'm saying is there's a quality we expect of leaders, and that's leadership. And when Hillary Clinton says something like, as she did the other day when she was asked what she thought of, she was asked what she thought of Peter Pace, the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff's views on homosexuality, and the reporters asked her point blank, "Do you think homosexuality is immoral?" And her answer was, "I'll leave that to others to decide."
Oh,
that,
my goodness,
is not leadership. Moreover, jeez, these queer and abortion wanting or needing folks and immigrants and people of color, we are your base, whether you like it or not. We demand and we deserve better than that.
Well, I think the Democratic Party thinks that those people are always going to vote Democrat, and so why bother pleasing them?
Well, why bother? Because, A, a lot of them don't vote Democrat. They simply don't vote. They're so alienated and pissed off. And secondly, these are the social networks, the most viable social networks we have in the country, in addition to the black churches and the labor movement that I've talked to you about. These are potentially the engines of movement at the base. People who are under threat are the most likely to be engaged most effectively. And to sort of diss them or discourage them from getting engaged on your behalf is just cutting off your nose to spite your face. So I'm not sure these people vote Democratic anyway. I think a lot of them do, but a lot of them don't vote. I think there are a lot of alienated voters to be attracted into the race. And besides, the arc of history is headed our way. Why not ride it?
We're talking to Laura Flanders. Let's go to one of the issues that I am personally obsessed about, namely voting accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
Why have Democrats been so reluctant to push for election reform, especially given the fact that voting problems really cost them votes, cost them entire elections?
Well, good question. I asked Howard Dean exactly that, and he said, "I don't know. It's like pulling teeth to get anybody in Washington to pay attention to this issue." Now, you know, I would say more cynically that it's been the case historically that both Democrats and Republicans have benefited from controlling the electorate, from controlling the franchise. We have a country that doesn't have a guaranteed democracy. We have a democracy whose rules are drawn up by some 470, I think, different governing bodies in the states, even going down to the county level. We have no federal voting rules other than age rules. We have instead this huge tapestry of different rules and regulations going state to state. So I think at the local level, again, people have made the rules work for them, and Democrats as much as Republicans, and they're loath to give up that power and pass, for example, a federal election law guaranteeing everybody of a certain age period a guaranteed right to vote. Why not receive a voting card in the mail when you turn 18? You tell me. Works in other countries. I don't know why it doesn't work in the United States.
I mean, but what you're saying is they're reluctant to regulate it because then they won't be able to cheat at some point in the future?
Well, that's pretty much what I'm saying. I mean, they're reluctant to take that power of the rulemaking out of the realm of arbitrary or political choice, because sooner or later they know they have that choice. But you're right. I mean, why the heck do they not stand up for their own voters? It's extraordinary. Louisiana, for example, the mayor's race, the only way that New Orleanian voters got the right to vote from Baton Rouge after the Broken Levee disaster of Katrina, when they were displaced to different parts of the state, the only way they got the right to vote in their home city was because you had legislators literally go and cry on the floor of the state house that people should be allowed to have satellite voting, vote where they were living now. And that was the same in the general election. The only way they got the right to vote outside of the place where they were registered was because state legislators, black ones, forced the governor to do the right thing. Those were Democratic voters. Why wasn't she fighting for them? When it came to the general election, the bigger question was, why did she turn down the right of people living in other states because of the flood to vote in Louisiana? They never got that right, even as Iraqis were being helped to vote from Detroit. So it's a bizarre question, and I'm afraid it speaks to the kind of corruption at the highest level of the party and at the state level, too. But it's also a blue grit
story. But it's a self-defeating corruption. That's what's so astounding.
Well, sometimes it works for you. Sometimes it works against, frankly. I would agree with you that it seems totally self-defeating, but I think there have been examples when it worked for them. So I don't want to be totally cynical. And in the book Blue Grit, I talk about how grassroots groups and state-level coalitions and national coalitions on these issues of voter integrity and sort of 21st century Jim Crow have actually forced the Democratic Party to take this stuff seriously. And I think that there's been a lot of movement on that front. You've got a new bill now in the House, the Rush Holt bill that could be brought up for debate any day, that is about a paperless voting trail, trail.
Paper ballots, yeah.
And they don't get the paper ballot yet, but they do have a paper record.
Trail, yeah.
2 years ago, even, those of us who were talking about stuff like that were considered complete cranks and conspiracists. So that's a lot of progress in a short amount of time.
There's a quotation at the beginning of one of your chapters on this subject in Blue Grit by new right strategist Paul Weyrich. He says, "I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down." That means conservative leverage.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, Democratic leverage can sometimes go the same way, although I'm with you. I think it's mostly worked to the Republicans' advantage. Controlling who can vote and who can't vote, that's part of the work of election campaigns. You try to turn out your people and make it easy for them and make it as hard as possible for the other folks. I don't believe it's a very healthy way to run an election. And I think most people around this country share that view, and they're beginning to stand up and demand some kind of a change. But has it been the nature of American democracy from the beginning? Absolutely. Controlling the franchise has been a key weapon in the powerful toolbox.
There's also the issue. Well, I mean, you claim that people from lower income brackets still vote predominantly for Democrats, Which really raises the question of why they don't win more often, considering that there are so many fewer rich people than poor.
Because it's harder for them to vote, and there are more obstacles for them to vote, and there's less for them to vote for. A lot of them feel there's nothing for them to vote for, and no candidate that speaks to their issues, and nobody who seems to care whether they vote or not. I think that's the problem, and that's what I'm hoping that some of these blue grit Democrats I'm talking about will help to turn around, because they're saying, look, you can get elected if you bring these voters into the mix, and this is how you do it.
So you are writing about places like Montana and Oregon and so on. Do you see some of these ideas, some of these blue grit ideas, making headway in Washington in that Democratic power establishment?
I think they're making some headway. Look at the debate about withdrawal in Iraq. It's not perfect, and it's not anywhere near biting enough, but it's a debate that would never have even happened, a few years back. So do the wheels of change move slowly? Absolutely. But I think we're seeing some change work its way through the process.
Laura Flanders, we've got just a moment or two left. Do you want to talk about any of your favorite candidates for upcoming elections in, say, 2008?
Well, I don't. I don't want to keep focusing on candidates. I really want us to focus for as long as we can in this process on that engine that I'm talking about at the base. If you want me to tell you some of my favorite blue grit groups that are out there trying to get the best out of whatever candidate it is, I would mention groups like the Progressive Leadership Alliance of Nevada or the Miami Workers Center in Miami, the League of Pissed Off Voters or Independent Voters, very powerful in Philly and Columbus and Milwaukee. There are great groups like the Progressive Majority who are trying to cultivate and support progressive candidates, and Young People Four who are trying to help young people stay in political engagement even once they leave the campus. I think that there is a kind of tide of blue grit stuff rising, and again, it makes a whole lot of people excited and makes a whole lot more uncomfortable. The question is, where will it go? And what's exciting is people are learning the ropes of the electoral system. They're learning how to get voting rolls and write up precinct maps and walk their blocks. They're learning how to contest those primaries, and they'll give some conservative Democrats a run for their money the next election, as they did in 2006. If with all those skills and all that savvy they begin to get alienated and discouraged with the Democratic Party, I think there's no reason to assume they won't get serious about building something else.
Well, Laura Flanders, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Oh, you're welcome, Mary Charlotte. I appreciate the time.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org, and we are podcasting. You can find us at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can send me an email at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.